Hello and welcome to, I think it's the 11th night, you know, it's the 10th night of Millennial 8. Now, I should say at the start that Keno Casino have had to cancel due to ill health. I think they're, one of them is ill. PPP is ill. Loads of folk are ill this year, and there have been quite a few cancellations, unfortunately, but there's nothing that can be done unless they can be rescheduled. Hopefully, well, I'll try, but we'll see. So as a result, I only have three streams tonight. In 2 hours, it's Faust, and then Jung Europa Verlag, which is a German publishing house. But first of all, it's the Ayatollah. Now, the Ayatollah is probably known to most of you. There's a tagline there, English content creator, singer, and impressionist. That's a bit tongue-in-cheek, but he does have those talents. Ayatollah, welcome to Millennial. You have been on before as part of TESOB, but why don't you introduce people and introduce yourself to people who don't know of you?
Yeah, thanks for having me. I mean, to be honest, I think content creator, singer, and impressionist are all a bit generous, truth be told.
I've heard you singing Nessun Dorma. Don't be modest.
Do you know, yeah, that video ended up on Instagram when it shouldn't. That was pre-doxing, and you can be heard at the end of that video. It was a bit of a half-assed effort, if I'm honest. I didn't want to kind of overdo it. But you can be heard at the end of that video sat next to the person videoing it saying, oh, bloody hell. But,
at least I wasn't trying to join in.
the worst part of it is, well, you've got the Italian ancestry woes, but the worst part of it is at the end of the video, I'm literally pointing at the person taking the video saying, that can't go anywhere. And where did it end up? It ended up on Instagram. But it was another two and a bit years before I got doxxed, but which is possibly the thing I'm best known for now. But yeah, I going back about 3.5 years, I got on the Absolute State of Britain podcast. As you said then, we were on Millennial in 2019. I mean, I'm ill again now as I was then. My voice gave out that night with sort of farcical results. So I'm hoping that's not going to happen again.
Everyone will understand. I'm still a bit groggy. You know, I've still got this lingering flu. But yeah, it's fine. I mean, I think everyone understands, so don't worry about it.
Yeah, and that was basically it. And I mean, I was on TASOB until like September 2020. TASOB's not going anymore, possibly for the best, because we pushed it quite hard, to be honest. And since then, really, I've just been kind of streaming first on YouTube and then latterly on Odyssey. And then a lot of which is very sort of off the cuff, low effort stuff for the most part. Some of it with a guest, some of it without. And then that's about it, really. I mean, and it's kind of sort of become its own self-referential thing of a lot of kind of insular humor with the audience and like daft impression requests and whatever else. But it was enough, as we're probably going to get onto. Well, I say this year, I think they were investigating me for a lot longer than that, but this year, to attract enough attention for me to be doxxed by none other than the world's oldest newspaper of record. So we'll come on to that later on, I'm sure.
Yeah, definitely. Well, I mean, doxxing is a big deal. And some people handle it very... It's not, you know, I think they're sort of optimized for it. But for other people, it's a very disturbing experience. And of course, also to do with your own personal circumstances at the time, it can be just inconvenient. It can be very annoying. You might lose your job. You might fall out with some relatives. The circumstances are going to be different for each person. But then the psychological impact is going to be different for each person as well. As I say, for some people, it's water off a duck's back. For others, it's a rather profound thing to happen. I think it was for me. I mean, but I'm not going to go into my own story because everyone knows that already. And we really should be talking about your story here. So, I mean, it also happened with the Iconoclast about a year earlier? I think it was a year earlier with him.
Was it? I think it was May 2020 or thereabouts. It wasn't that long before he lost his YouTube channel. I think it was actually around about May 2020, late May 2020.
Right, okay. And then you, well, so it's actually quite a while. It's more like 2 years before you were doxxed. And it was the Times, and it was why don't you tell the story and maybe lay the groundwork by saying what you'd been involved in and the possible motivations for doxxing you.
Yeah, well, I mean, basically, I mean, I'll be honest, there was a part of me who part of me who, I mean, that's a good start, isn't it? No, there was a part of me that I kind of, whenever the State of Hate report came out every year and some of my mates got featured in it, I was kind of feeling a bit left out, you know, and that, sort of thinking, well,
just,
you know,
for the sake of clarification, that's Hope Not Hate's annual.
Yeah.
Annual.
And, yeah, that's it. Yeah, we're the only people that read it, let's be honest, you know, so.
Mm. Yeah, yeah, I'm not even sure that they read it.
Well,
it's so low effort, you know. Oh, yeah, but anyway, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, but then, basically, Dominic Kennedy, of all people, investigations editor at the Times, and he's had that position for 18 years, so he's, you know, he's pretty seasoned. He showed up at the family home on, I think it was Monday, August the 8th, and it wasn't myself that answered the door. Somebody else answered the door. I'd not heard the door go. Didn't hear the doorbell. And then by the time whoever was at the door had left, I was aware that it was about me, and just from someone I'd overheard. And a business card had been left. So I got in touch with Dominic Kennedy via email, basically saying, what do you want? And if you want to deal with me, you can deal with me via this email address. You know, do not come back to the property. Now, he responded with 63 questions via email, to which over the course of about 7 or 8 drafts over the preceding sort of 5 or 6 days, I eventually went back to him with 8,696 words.
What did the 63 questions pertain to?
All kinds of daft things. Let me go back and have a look. I mean, what the first one was, why do you run a racist YouTube channel?
A leading question at all, is it?
No, not in the least. No, there were many. I mean, if I go back and have a look through some of them, there were some absolute crackers, as you can well imagine. Let's have a look. What did we have? I'm looking in the wrong place for that one, for a start. There were things like, you know, what is the goal of Patriotic Alternative? Because I was at one time I was never formally affiliated with Patriotic Alternative as being an actual member. I've never been involved in the time of the vetting thing, but I still get invited to national events and so on. And, you know, I'm broadly pro sort of Patriotic Alternative in my streams and that kind of thing. So one of the questions was like, what's the goal of Patriotic Alternative? Is it to incite violence? And I mean, I think this tells you a lot about the modus operandi of somebody like Dominic Kennedy, which is just like, okay, this guy probably isn't completely stupid, but there's always the chance we catch him in a fit of pique and he just sort of like fed posts, basically, as we would call it, you know, yeah. And like we trip him up. I mean, I remember hearing somebody describe being interviewed by him and saying like they'd never known anything like it, because he was sort of, he would ask you a question. You would basically deconstruct the question and more or less give an answer that he ought to find humiliating. And he'd just say, yeah, okay, next one then. And basically it's just like like the modus operandi of like a depressed psychopath, just moving on to the next one of, right, okay, didn't get him there. Move on to the next one. I'll try and get him with the next question. And basically that, but there was, why do you run a racist YouTube channel? I was accused of inciting people to think that there's a genocide happening, as if, like, you know, hundreds of hotels up and down the country filled with fighting age foreign men aren't doing that, but I am, with a small YouTube channel, which had audiences of about 120
people. Well, this is the key, the characteristic thing where...
Victim blaming.
You get blamed for pointing out the problem.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah.
As if the problem isn't a problem. But you pointing it out, obviously, is you're trying to cause trouble.
Yeah, naturally, yeah. It's shooting the messenger, it's victim blaming. I was also asked how I justified what I'd said about David Lammy being a funded agent of a certain foreign ethno-religious group when there was an article in one of their own publications proudly proclaiming that a group of their lawyers funded his Harvard law education. I was also asked why I referred to Muslims as people who like to face the bingo hall. That was literally a euphemism used to, well, it was a reference to the Mecca bingo chain. It was a euphemism.
Oh, of course.
Yeah, yeah, well, that was a euphemism we used literally to not name them as Muslims whilst talking about some of the misdeeds that happened to be associated with that group in Britain.
The bingo hall regarders.
The bingo hall regarders, yeah. And I mean, I did sort of query with that is like, well, what I did query with that in response to Dominic Kennedy is... you know, if I'd referred to Icelandic people as former Bijam shoppers, for anyone who's old enough to remember Iceland once being called Bijam, the frozen food shop, then like would that have you in paroxysms of rage as well? So, I mean, it was ridiculous. I was also asked why I admire both Derek Day and Adolf Hitler, both mentioned in the same breath. Derek Day being an ex-national frontman from the East End of London, and Hitler being, you know, apparently the devil. They've just been put on par in terms of historical significance in that question. So, I mean.
Derek Day is your avatar, isn't he?
He is, yeah, yeah. He was a sort of a National Front organizer and security man in the East End of London in the 70s and the 80s. Famously climbed out of the window of his flat in Hoxton to go and confront some journalists who were harassing him.
And threatened to break their fucking jaw.
Yeah, yeah. It was, what's going on now? Any people have been mad? Don't lay your hands on me, son, because I'll break your fucking jaw. Yeah, two syllables of the word jaw. Yeah, proper sort of like proper East End stuff. So there you are.
I mean, it's sad to think that accent just... I mean, I'm not going to say it's the most pleasant accent to hear, but it is sad to think that it's just extinct now. It just doesn't exist.
Yeah.
I mean, I remember walking through London once, and about 4 years ago, and I heard this guy, and I think he was like in his, I don't know, late 50s.
Mm.
And he had a certain accent. And I said to my friend, I was walking with a friend, and I said, that accent, once he's gone, there will be no one who speaks like that. It was a certain well-spoken Cockney kind of thing. Mm.
Well, the thing with that is, I mean, I remember the first time I saw Derek Day, and I knew nothing about him at the time. I just saw the video and found it sort of very funny and sort of quite energizing. The voice is going again, but I think I'll be all right. But the sort of the sadness and the anger I had is, like, everything this bloke said was proven right, and people like him were ultimately defeated. Because look at, you know, this was Hyde Road in Hoxton, and you'd only have to look at Hoxton any time in the last 30 years, you know, let alone if not longer.
Absolutely. But, there's a Telegram channel that's just started, and I've been sharing its stuff, and I've got a number more posts scheduled from them that I've forwarded, and it's called Forgotten History UK.
Yeah, I know the one, yeah.
It's so good, it's so interesting, and it's very London-centric, but I don't really mind that, I don't care really. There is so much about London. And this is what I always say about London, you know, there are so many bits of it. It goes on and on and on. And it's fascinating. And one of the things about this, and it's a very obvious point to make, but I'll make it. One of the things about all these old photos of London from like 100 years ago, 120 years ago, 50 years ago, is that everyone is white.
Mm.
And I don't even, I don't think this is a white nationalist Telegram channel, by the way. I'm not sure. I don't think it is. I haven't seen any signs of that. But they can't help but make the point just by showing the evidence. These are many, many, many communities that have been completely decimated and
dissolved,
erased.
Yeah. I mean, I actually made this point to Dominic Kennedy in one of my answers. If I go and refer back to it, I actually made the point about basically the dissolution of Cockneys as a kind of like as kind of a people within London. I actually made the point in one of my answers. But I mean, I've raised the point before, like, you know, it's a really jarring incongruity for anyone that wants to advocate for the demographic state of Britain and the present order's agendas with regard to immigration and demographics and what they've been doing for so long. It's a real sort of jarring incongruity and something that's difficult for them to answer for. Because, I mean, I've cited the example before of war memorials, you know, setting World War memorials. I'm not that far from Birmingham. I remember going through a couple of different parts of Birmingham on different occasions and just noticing, as you would expect, the memorials to the dead of the bombings in the Second World War, or like dead servicemen. It's Smith and Davis and Williams and Brown and Jones and Richardson, and you get the idea. You know, there aren't too many Singhs and Khans and Adebayos and whatever else. And that's a very embarrassing thing for them, to the point where there's a party that wonders, like, at what point are these things going to be pulled down because they're not representative of modern Britain and the Britain these people were said to have been fighting for.
Well, absolutely. I mean, and this is why it's so galling to see Rishi Sunak holding up the coin, diversity built Britain. That is absolutely, obviously a lie. And an egregious and outrageous lie, but they have to assert it, because otherwise it simply wouldn't be true. But as you just said there, the Britain that is now, the Britain that we now live in, you could say was built by diversity. I mean, the Britain that we have to suffer is one that would have been alien to our ancestors, like four generations ago, completely, even two. I mean, the boomers, I don't think they really understand what's going on.
Yeah, I mean, this actually, I've just found it, is we were talking about the Cockneys. One of his questions was, the aims of patriotic alternatives, such as creating a supermajority of what you see as whites, cannot be achieved without mass force movements of peoples, which can only be achieved through violence. I mean, I rebutted the thing about violence. I made the point that if there were any restoration of a supermajority of whites, well, it would be just that, a restoration. You know, no one was asked if they wanted this. It was imposed upon us from on high, and look at the consequences. I mean, we've since seen the census results where we're only 74% of the population in England and Wales, you know.
I mean, you say that we were never asked, and that obviously is a very, in a sense, that's true. There was never a referendum or whatever.
Yeah.
But in another sense, it's not true, because we actually were asked and we were polled time and time again on this matter.
Yeah.
And every single time we voted against it.
Yeah.
So it's actually worse than would be suggested by.
It is. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I kind of took issue with Dominic Kennedy saying what you see is white. So I kind of pointed out that was regime issue, anti-white gaslighting and deconstruction, and that I would treat it with the contempt it deserves. I also pointed out how reminiscent it was of the kind of things that, say, like certain governments in the Middle East would do when they got a problem ethnic group within their borders that they basically wanted to totally disenfranchise and more or less dissolve. Yeah, basically. You know, like the way it's happened with Kurds in parts of different countries in the Middle East. I mean, I know the Kurds are something of like a kind of, they're like darlings of the neocons and whatever and the Zionists, but setting that aside, it has happened with them, particularly in Turkey. But Assyrians are another one in Iraq and Syria. And I'd kind of ask whether that's reminiscent of anything. Is it reminiscent of the way that Cockneys, their dialect and their culture barely exist anymore? And this was with reference to, like, it was hyperlinked to an article, because they've basically been ethnically cleansed and dissolved out into the home counties. By massive influxes of foreigners. What I thought was interesting about it, basically, yeah, so Dominic Kennedy turned up on the 8th of August. I think I'd sent him my answers by about the 15th. I was then doxed on, well, kind of across the 31st of August and the 1st of September in the Times. I mean, it was they did push the boat out. There were two podcasts totaling about 75 minutes, one on the 31st, which promised like the big reveal the following day. Who is Britain's most racist YouTuber, as Red Flair described me? I mean, that one's, you know, getting carved into my headstone in granite. Then there were two articles, and there was a YouTube clip on the Times YouTube channel as well, in which, they were pretty emphatically ratioed. GB News picked it up as well. The Guardian picked it up and asked me for a quote, which they duly received. And
what was GB News's angle on it?
It was like, you know when you get like the sort of the paper review on Sky News and that kind of thing. It was like that. I mean, it was actually that they were almost jocular about it in a way. Like, oh, he's been a bit of a naughty boy, hasn't he? Because he said this, that, and the other. It was like. It was quite strange. I only went back and watched it once, but they obviously they weren't saying, oh, good on him, because they're like, you know, to the right of Sky News. But it was like, he's been a bit of a naughty boy, hasn't he? You know, with his racist YouTube channel and whatever. But I mean, the Campaign Against Anti-Semitism did an article about it. A couple of Jewish and Israeli publications picked it up. So it went a fair way. The two most interesting things about it, to be honest, are the quotes they chose to publish. And there's a bit to be said about that. And then there's also, really just the support I had from the community. I mean, I've got to say on that, I'm obviously not just saying this for your benefit, but you were sort of foremost among that, Woz. I mean, you've been through it, so you know what it's like, but there were many, I was overwhelmed with the amount of support I had, and the amount of people that I just didn't even know were aware of me, to be honest, sort of expressing their support both publicly and privately, offering to help if I needed it, which in the end I didn't. But you know, you were very good, particularly in updating me on the like to dislike ratio on that aforementioned YouTube video on the Times YouTube channel.
Well, people were reporting that to me because I don't have a YouTube account anymore.
So yeah, yeah.
I was asking people to keep, you know, report it in my life, my Telegram group, and then I would relay that to you. As I said, you never know how doxing is going to affect someone, and you never know how much moral support they're going to need and practical support they're going to need.
Yeah.
So they might deal with it well, or they might be fucked. You know, they might be in a pit of despair and fear about it. You never know. So that was why for the general community feel, I thought it was important that we stick. I mean, it's always important that there's solidarity.
Yeah. Yeah, and I mean, and I appreciate that a great deal. I mean, the thing with it is, I think it's the first few hours and it's the first day, but it's particularly the first few hours when it really starts to sort of get around and sort of blow up, because you don't know how far it's going to go, and it's more than not knowing than necessarily anything that actually happens.
Exactly. I remember.
Yeah.
Now that you say that, I remember what it was like for me. It was just such worry. You don't know what's going to happen, what it's going to lead to. And that is very frightening at the time. And I remember saying to you, just don't worry too much. You know, whatever happens, you will get through it.
Yeah, that's it. Yeah, and people you know, telling you things like that, it makes all the difference. I mean, I did say, like, on the evening of it, I said, like, to be totally honest, you know, watching the sort of armchair Antifa on Twitter getting all excited about this, like there's going to be some sort of reckoning, I think they'd be quite dispirited and kind of dismayed if they knew how things actually work behind the scenes among nationalists, because people really do get behind you. I mean, I could have had about 10 holidays out of it if I wanted. It was, come to Norfolk, come to Cornwall, come to Ireland, come to Lanzarote in one case. No, but I was all right, fortunately. But it was the quotes that they went with were very interesting. I mean, first of all, Red Flare, they worked in conjunction with Red Flare. They were investigating for a long time. It's amazing how much effort they put into it, considering I'm basically a shit poster who streams to audience. I told Dominic Kennedy this, you know, you're putting all this effort in for a bloke whose live, like, maximum live audiences could fit in a large pub. It was 120 people at that time.
I imagine, you know, he interpreted that as, please leave me alone, I'm no harm to anyone.
He may have, but I mean, I'll be honest, and anyone can read him. They're on Countercurrents, actually. All my answers to him went on Countercurrents, and I wasn't particularly a shrinking violet in the answers I gave him. Mm. I worded certain things where the questions were like the most dicey for me. I worded them carefully. You've got to think in that mindset if they're going to go for whatever they perceive as the weakest. Oh, however, yeah. I also had a strong sense, because this has happened time and time again over recent years with you know, when they've kind of come after people in the dissident right and they've ended up giving the right of reply. I did have a feeling, you know, like, choose your best words carefully as well. Because there's these people very often, whether it's their tone deafness, whether it's how profoundly out of touch they are with average people, or whether it's just a calculated gamble on their part that they can kind of cow and psychologically abuse their audience more into kind of not thinking in the wrong way as they would perceive it, they very often end up publishing a lot of our most incisive critiques of the present order and its agendas. I mean, that I'll come to with the quotes that went in the article. But yeah, Red Flare, who they worked with, I mean, Red Flare had, you know, like, got weirdos in bushes taking photographs at PA events and that. So I got doxed as the man who was wearing a Hawaiian shirt at a camping trip in 2021.
Oh, yes.
And yes. Joked about being the Hawaii Atollah. You know, they had to put a caption like, you know, Owens joked about being referred, that he should be called the Hawaii Atollah, in the sort of caption in their article. It's like, you're trying to portray me as someone who's terrifying, you know, like public enemy number one. And it's like, it's a guy who went on a camping trip in a Hawaiian shirt, you know, and joked about it. Like,
well, they do this. Yeah. They do both of these things at once. They try to present as a very dangerous man, but also as a joke, a clown that people should laugh down on. So they do that simultaneously. Yeah. It's quite strange, actually.
It's quite sort of schizophrenic. It's weird. Yeah.
Yeah. One thing that is worth emphasizing here is that this was the Times, supposedly in a crusty conservative newspaper, collaborating with Red Flare.
Hmm.
This is very significant, because it means that, you know, the establishment is, I mean, it's not even surprising to people, but it is significant that the establishment is all one thing, really.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. I mean, there's a reason we've sort of past couple of years taken to calling it a regime, because it is very much a regime. But Red Flare, I mean, again, to my eternal honour, Red Flare, who were described as an anti-far-right collective that monitors extremists, described me as Britain's most racist YouTuber. This was quoted in the Times article. And they said that the degree of vitriol, malice, and the kind of incandescent rage with which he speaks about ethnic minorities, gay people, Jews, the left, is unique among his peers. I mean, I think they were giving me a bit too much... I think they were giving me a bit too much credit in that, given that a lot of my streams are basically like, hi, Toller, what do you think of Hall & Oates, and do you prefer a Mars or a Snickers? So I'm selling
The incandescent rage that could arise from those topics is just beyond imagining.
Oh, quite, yeah. I mean, they really, like, on the podcast, Dominic Kennedy, who was sort of hosted by David Aronovich on this, you know, the arch-Zionist, big supporter of the Iraq war and everything, Dominic Kennedy made a big play of saying that, like, it's all sort of infighting on the dissident right. The Ayatollah is completely different. It's just pure rage. Like, I won't repeat what he said, because it's too awful for you to hear, but trust me, it's pure rage. very little of it is, to be honest, because, you know, as I say, like, about once a week, if rage refuel, I've had a full tank for years and I just kind of want to relax a little bit. And a lot of what I talk about isn't actually political.
Didn't David Aronovich, about a few years ago, I'm sure he said something about white, like, there is no such thing as white interest. And of course,
white interest can never be right. Yeah, something like that.
Yeah, that's it. Defending white interest can never be right. The Times,
right,
2017, that was.
Yeah, that's right, yeah.
It's obviously worth pointing out that David Aronovich is Jewish.
Yeah, half Irish, half Jewish, yeah.
Half Irish.
He's completely non-white. Yeah, for any sort of Irish listeners, there's the standard Noel Ignatiev joke for the night. As I said, I mean, the one thing I'll say on the quotes they use that, well, there are a couple of things to say because very similar quotes made it into the article and the second podcast in which I was kind of outed and identified by name. I mean, they even started the second episode. Wait for it. With a clip of me and my father singing Father and Son by Cat Stevens. It wasn't a karaoke night. I'd done a singing competition on a whim, got through to a regional final and won it, and got through to the national final. And we're having a bit of a celebration after. And me and my dad got up and sang Father and Son by Cat Stevens. And they began the podcast with that. Luckily, they could have done me worse because they played me singing the second verse and not the third verse. And I was shocking in the third verse and not quite as bad in the second. So they showed me a bit of mercy. But like the quotes they went with, I mean, first of all, in the article, and they used my answer to the first question, why do you run a racist YouTube channel? And as I said previously, like, they've got an incredible habit, whatever the reasons may be, whether it's just profound tone deafness or whether it's a calculated assessment that actually, if we use something that sounds really reasonable but make it clear to our audience that it isn't, you know, that keeps them in line and has the desired effect from like a narrative point of view and like a conditioning point of view. I don't know, but the quote they went with was as follows. It was, "I use YouTube to communicate with, entertain, and hopefully lift the spirits of other non-compliant white people, by which I mean white people who reject the psychological abuse, dispossession, and humiliation of the present anti-white order. I'm trying to provide myself and the audience with a bit of relief in a very hostile, alienating world. I outright reject the concept of racism," quote, end quote. "It's simply an anti-white libel and a weapon of mass psychological abuse devised and wielded to keep white people from thinking and acting in our own interest while our sovereignty and our homelands are taken from us." Now, if I could have chosen any quote from the many in the article out of nearly 8,700 words to go in there, that would have been the one, because the anti-white kind of libel of racism is at the center of the way that people are browbeaten and cowed and kept in line. I often refer back to the 50th anniversary retrospectives you did on the so-called Rivers of Blood speech by Enoch Powell, and how even as far back as that, like local residents in his constituency, which I think was in Wolverhampton, were afraid of being called racist. The spell that they've created over white people with that concept is remarkable. So if there were one thing I could have chosen to go in the article, it would have been that. And sure enough, they did exactly as I suspected they might, which is, you know, go with probably the most incisive critique of the whole thing. And they did a similar thing on the podcast. They went with basically the same sort of quote, and they put it over a bed of like ominous sound design, like soundscaping, you know, like for any Peep Show fans, it was real "The Longer the Note, the More Dread" stuff. Like they had Dominic Kennedy slowly intone it with a bit of reverb on his voice, saying,
really?
Basically, oh yeah, no, this one was as follows. I mean, it's more or less identical to the second part of the previous quote. It was, "I reject the concept of racism outright, and I view it with nothing but contempt. The concept of racism is simply an anti-white libel and a weapon of mass psychological abuse devised and wielded to keep white people from thinking and acting in our own interests while our sovereignty and our homelands are taken from us. I refuse to be gaslit and victimized in this way, as all people should." And that sounds farcical to us, that they'd stick that over a sort of a bed of ominous soundscaping. But from the point of view of maybe not these people, but certainly the people whose interests they serve, that is scary to them. The idea of any number of white people thinking in that way and speaking in those terms, it is terrifying. Because imagine if that caught on and even a few percent of the population actively thought and acted in those terms and interacted with the world and with the propaganda they see in those terms, and particularly if they collectivized, that would be quite a serious problem. If you had 5-10% of people thinking and acting in those terms with that vocabulary, yeah, that would be a real problem for them. And that is why, even at the level I'm at, I had 120 live viewers on average, concurrent live viewers. Even at that level, yeah, they may well come after you and sort of try and make an example of you and try and say, "God, isn't this terrifying? We need more stringent laws to deal with this." It's extraordinary. But it goes back to something the Woodlander said. I mean, I had the Woodlander on my channel a few weeks ago, and he made the point, and obviously he's a veteran of the nationalist cause going back to the National Front days in the 1980s. And he'd said, you know, there probably only ever been a few thousand genuine, unapologetic racial nationalists in Britain, but the powers that be always were and remain terrified of us. And that could be seen as excessive, but maybe it's not. You know, that they understand it takes and it has taken a hell of a lot of effort in propaganda and basically various methods of, as I've said, mass psychological abuse and conditioning to demoralize and cow and subdue the racial instincts of our people, whether that be the peoples of Britain or white peoples the world over. And that they know that where expressions of positive and unapologetic white racial consciousness, were they ever allowed even a small victory, there's potentially quite a significant momentum that could then accrue, because it's ultimately just it's only a return to the only way of thinking and understanding the world and of thinking of one's own people and conceiving of ourselves that is natural and as healthy and as in our interests. And were it to reach a point of critical mass, well, I mean, you know, there'd be a lot of people in professions like journalism and media and the police and the judiciary and politics and the intelligence services who'd find themselves being asked some very difficult questions.
Yeah. White Papers just today, White Papers, who was on Millennial a couple of days ago, reported that Giorgio Meloni has just been voted. Hold on, I'll just find this. Since winning the election, Giorgio Meloni has become not only Italy's most popular leader for decades, but also the most popular leader in all of Europe. It's quite amazing what stopping a few refugee boats can do for a politician. Now, the point I'm making here is, this is how just under the surface white racial awakening actually is. And I'm not even saying that Giorgia Meloni is, you know, our girl. I'm just saying all she had to do was stop a few refugee boats, and it has skyrocketed her popularity. So it's just under there, you know? And I think this is why they are so scared of it. And you're right, you know, they don't put all of this effort in for no reason. All this effort to oppress us and inconvenience us, obstruct us. They're doing that because they are so, they know how immediately latent this is.
Yeah, and a lot of it is associated with people having a sort of a perception that they've got a bit of permission to actually speak, you know. That's basically it. And as you said, yeah, under the surface, yeah.
Yeah, and if people see that someone else gets away with saying this stuff, then, I mean, there's a really, you know, I go back to my own experience of this. It was, I think it was July 2015 when Hope Not Hate first asked people to dox me. They first asked for my identity. And by then, and I only had a few thousand subscribers on YouTube. I'd been going for a year and a half. And I certainly wasn't a public figure in anything but the dictionary sense. I certainly wasn't famous, didn't have influence. But they knew that the channel was steadily growing. And that was enough for them to put out a call for people to dox me. I mean, and I'm not boasting here, I'm just using that as the example, because they know if people see one person getting away with saying this stuff, it will spread quickly. Whereas if they see instead that the person who talked about this and only had a few thousand subscribers gets fucked, then that will send the right message. They don't even risk it. Don't even
the nail. The nail that sticks up gets hammered down. Yeah, to quote an old, I think it's like a Japanese proverb or something.
Propaganda
repurposed it quite well in Today's Empires, Tomorrow's Ashes. But I mean, there was, I don't know what you think of this, but it just instantly called to mind a point that I've made before about, like, there are instant, and I think populism was the classic example of this. I think I also, just in the sense that, like, when they rail against populism, that, you know, I mean, it's quite explicit what they're railing against, and it's a bit of a mask slip. You know, they're railing against the popular will, you know, just the interests of, like, normal people. Likewise with, what was the other example I was going to cite? It was like tolerance. You know, tolerance is another, no one's ever asked you to tolerate, like, a lottery, like a Euro Millions rollover win. You know, you'll never be asked to tolerate that. You'll never be asked to tolerate, you know, having fantastic bone structure, you know, or having a beautiful wife. No one's ever going to ask you to tolerate that. You're only ever asked to tolerate things that are just bad for you. So the appeal, the constant appeals for and demands for tolerance are quite a sort of, they could even be seen as like a bit of a psychological flex, but a tolerance is generally something which is demanded of people when it's they're being subjugated, but it's known that if they don't comply soundly enough, then the people responsible for the subjugation could be in a bit of bother. You know, there's quite a mass behind the subjugated which could present a problem if they actually kind of started to act, you know, to act in response. But I mean, those are just other examples, but the thing I was going to cite was the idea of casual racism. People that lament, and I've heard this in workplaces, and that, you know, I had to reprimand him early for just casual racism. It's like, well, what do you mean by casual racism? What you mean, what people actually mean when they talk about casual racism is, yeah, racism as it's described, which is to say, like, you know, any non-compliant thought or speech where race is concerned or ethnicity or whatever else, it does come naturally. It is casual. You know, it, yeah, it comes, it's casual because it comes naturally because it's normal.
And in all races as well.
Yes, I mean, this exactly.
Is just,
yeah.
This is just the natural process of people noticing differences between themselves and other people.
It's collective it's basically a tool of collective self-censorship, because it's basically admonishing the transgressor for not doing the bit, not playing the game, not going along with actually speaking of the fact that they believe their lying eyes, not going along with the program of everyone just sort of pretending to believe that the emperor's, you know, beautifully attired rather than bollock naked, basically. Yeah. That's what it is. That's what it is when people, and again, they don't realize they're giving it away, but when people rail against casual racism, that's what it is. Yeah, racism, as you would describe it, does come naturally. It is casual. It's not even a malevolent thing in most contexts. And to the extent that it becomes a problem, that's generally only a problem in, you know, in artificially diversified societies where there are conflicting group interests. Well, who's responsible for that? It isn't us.
Oh, absolutely. On the matter of tolerance, I think this is an interesting thing, because they've always called for, throughout, you know, from the 50s through to the, I guess, the 2000s, 2010s, they've called for tolerance from the majority of British, the native Brits, yeah, have been asked to be tolerant. And I think the underlying assumption there is you can afford to tolerate this thing because you're always going to be the majority. So therefore, yeah, why wouldn't you tolerate this? It's unkind for you not to tolerate this. Yeah. But that assumes that, well, we are in the position of power. We are in the position of majority. So we've got the choice to whether to tolerate this or to object to it. And it would be selfish of us not to tolerate it. But as the demographics have shifted, I think the regime has shifted from saying that we have to tolerate it, diversity, to saying that we have to celebrate diversity. And that has been concurrent with the gradual admission that, yeah, we are being not replaced. They're still not admitting that, but they're saying it's going to be a very, very mixed society. So this isn't something for you to tolerate. You're not in a position to tolerate it. This is something for you to celebrate. It's not your choice to tolerate it. It's your duty to celebrate it. That's the shift that's happened here, because they think that we no longer have that authority anymore.
You kind of have to celebrate it as a quasi-religious duty, but then in the next breath, if we want to, you know, basically say, well, look, you deserve this for colonialism, we'll take that line as well.
And you see this
trickle down to the level of the kind of like the mushrooms on Twitter of all races, by the way, who, you know, who kind of attack anyone who makes any sort of pro-white statement. That they'll flip. It's the classic sort of thing. That they'll flip on a dime from, I don't know why I say that, sixpence, whatever. We don't even have them anymore. You know, from like, I mean,
a diversity 50 pence piece.
Perfect. Yeah. Well, there you go. I mean, I was born 14 years after decimalization, I think, so I don't know what I'm talking about. But yeah. That's right. Yeah. Like the sort of, really, in terms of the way that this is kind of, these lines of argument are handed down to the plebs, like, there's not really any need for any kind of like rigor or continuity within any of it, because, like, you know, in any sort of exchange, most people may as well have the comprehension and the memory of a goldfish. So it doesn't matter, does it? But yeah, it is an amazing thing to watch. Yeah, absolutely.
It's frightening. And this is all to do with the engineering of public opinion and the manufacturing of consent. And consensus.
Yeah.
And it is frightening how this happens. And I don't know, maybe it's always happened. It probably always has. But the issue is that, you know, 100 years ago, the elite weren't so brazen. Well, I don't think they were against the majority public, whereas now they are. So all of that apparatus for opinion forming is suddenly used against the majority public and their continued existence. I mean, it's a very, again, you know, about 6 months or a year ago, I found another load of photos, and I think it was of Eastbourne. I can't remember how I got that. It was one of those days when you just start Googling stuff, and for some reason, and it leads you to this, and that leads you to that. And I ended up seeing all these photos of Victorian Eastbourne. And it was lovely, you know, the old shops and a park with a pond and a sort of terrace of trees. And I thought, wow, imagine, and I said this on Telegram, I put that photo up and I said, imagine being in this park and knowing that you're going to go for a walk around this town, Eastbourne, and everyone you're going to meet is going to be of your ethnic group. Yeah. And there will just be no troubles, no problems, no bullshit, no need to know anything about other cultures. Yeah. And that's another part of it. You know, I don't like this idea that there's a duty for you to know about other cultures. Why? Who consented to this? Who asked for this? Who agreed to this? I think that most people aren't optimized for that. There are always going to be some who have a genuine curiosity about other, and indeed a lot of them are actually in our movement. There are people who know a lot about Indian history and Mexican history and so on. But they're still, they would still be called racist by the mainstream. Oh, yeah. I think that there are some people who are going to have that curiosity, but most people don't. And most people should be very concerned with what's going on in their local area. And I think that that would be a healthier thing. I mean, the Instagram thought of today, she should be, what would she be 100 years ago? She'd be some local girl in a local town who might be a bit flirtatious, but that would be the extent of it. She would be engrossed, immersed in her local area and the culture, the stuff that's going on there. That's how people are supposed to be. That's how the vast majority of people are evolved to be. And you go.
No, I mean, what I was going to say, just on the kind of the idea of the sort of the manufacture of consent and everything. I think the thing that is dizzying about it today and sort of disturbing is just the reach and sophistication of it because of modern, you know, basically mass communication technology and everything. I think particularly in the era of the smartphone. Now they've had their problems with that, the decentralization of it. But it's a very insidious thing. But I mean, and like you said, I think the agendas of the present order are just that much more hostile toward, and also, I mean, not just hostile, but dehumanizing. Their agendas are that much more kind of hostile and dehumanizing than at times in the past. Now, don't get me wrong. You know, I mean, treacherous kind of elite figures in Europe, unfortunately, is a tale as old as time. You know, you've only got to go and listen to, say, Dr. Andrew Joyce talk about, well, a certain question, let's say, and the role of money lending and basically like treacherous nobles and royals in that kind of thing and screwing their own people. It's not a new thing, sadly, but it certainly, you know, has it manifested itself to the extent of like a million foreigners being brought into a country of 65 million odd people a year previously? I don't think it has. You know, the idea, I mean, I was talking about this, I did a stream on my channel last night where I did a themed sort of a theme about Sam Fender, the singer-songwriter. He had a song called White Privilege. And I was basically making the point that, look, if we had privilege, we'd never hear about it because there'd be nobody in a position to complain about it. Because if we had privilege, you know, I mean, it's you know you're under the cosh and being subject to sort of mass blanket psychological abuse when you can be admonished for having privilege, when you obviously haven't got it by the very different definition of the fact that you're being, you know, you're being sort of browbeaten for having it. And you're receiving a lot of this browbeating from foreigners of one type or another who've literally got material privileges over you by virtue of their foreignness in your fucking country.
Yes.
So, you know, there you are. Yeah.
Yeah, it's crazy. But again, this is the kind of thing where you realise that, you know, that's really enforced in universities, lecture halls.
Yeah, yeah.
And so you realise most people who, let's say, have an IQ of 110, they can pass an exam and whatever, they really aren't intellectually curious. They're not inquisitive at all, because if they were, they would be thinking about this stuff and they would really, the penny would drop. It would occur to them, oh, well, this doesn't make sense. We're constantly deconstructing and attacking, undermining this group who supposedly have the power.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. And the reason they worry, and again, look, because you say people with 110 IQs, well, I mean, to be honest, I think that's probably, a lot of us are probably in that range in our thing, but we've just got better temperaments. We've got that bit more piss and vinegar.
You know, My point there is that being above average doesn't really mean much. In and of itself, it just doesn't. I mean, a lot of the folk who fell for COVID are very bright people.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, a lot of our kind of thought leaders within the dissident right, they are sort of 130, 140 IQ people. And a lot of us take our cues from them. I kind of made this point in another of my answers to Dominic Kennedy. What they worry about, what people like the people who would, you know, dox you and dox me worry about is the fact that actually, yeah, in other circumstances, that the very simple points we make are very kind of very easily understood. You know, if you can make someone with 110 IQ understand the sort of farcical, the risible idea of white privilege, you can pretty easily make them understand that, yeah, white people have got group interests and know nobody anything. You know, that's even easier. You can do that with people, you know, across the sort of range of intellectual capability. And that of course, is what they worry about. But yeah,
and it's so easy. I mean, I could do it right now. You know, do other people have privilege in your household, or do you rightly have privilege in your household? Exactly. The answer is the latter. So then that means, okay, well, why not extend that to the country? That's what everyone else is doing, after all, and it's what we used to do. So that means that we should have privilege in our own country. And it's not even privilege, it's just rightful ownership. So there you go. Done.
That's it. Yeah, it is. Yeah.
So I guess that gets us to, well, unless there's anything else that you want to say about the doxing, because I want this to be your chance to tell this story. That sounds a bit dorky phrasing, but you know, this is something very significant that's happened to you. So is there anything else that you'd want to say about it?
No, I don't think so. I mean, other than, again, actually, just to thank people for kind of all the solidarity they showed. I mean, yourself and many other people, quite a few of them would be in the chat. I think there are one or two people in there that basically said, yeah, come and have a holiday. And I was all right. But no, I don't think so. No, I think we've covered all of that. I think what was interesting about it, as I say, was just what we would perceive as hysterical overreaction, but then maybe we don't give ourselves quite enough credit.
Yeah. That's an interesting point. As you said earlier, they are frightened. They are very frightened of this stuff spreading. And even with all the social media against us, you know, the platforms, that they're still frightened. And it is because, you know, it is interesting that they attacked you. And I obviously don't like it and I don't approve of it, but it seems telling that they went for you.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know. There's a part of me that did wonder, you know, were they, did they not like the fact that I crack a joke and everything? I mean, I don't crack it to very many people, so they'd have done better not to draw any attention to it, to be honest. But I do think, I mean, I will say this, one thing that sort of does occur to me now, I did, when I got doxxed, see a lot of kind of acolytes of like real midwit Antifa type accounts and Red Flare on Twitter basically going on about, oh, he was really horrible. I remember him when he was on, he was really horrible to me. He's like, well, yeah, of course I was. Look at you. But like, you know, basically they were like really vengeful about it. Like, oh, he's in for it now and whatever. And they were kind of getting themselves all riled up about it. And maybe there's an element of that. Like I probably was quite vitriolic to some people who actually associate with and work for Red Flare at different times. And they probably didn't like it because I've got quite an acerbic tongue. And if I'm going to have anything, I'll have that. Like, as I said, like that they, you know, Red Flare gave me the honor of calling me Britain's most racist YouTuber. And like, I'll never shut up about it. And yeah, as I said, I might have that inscribed into my headstone one day. You know, not my words, the words of Red Flare. So, yeah.
So I guess that brings us. Well, actually, one thing I would like to ask is there anywhere that we can see these? I think, did you say 67 questions? 67? How?
63, how, yeah.
63. How did he think? That in itself is amazing. Was he? It's like, I'll ask a person 63 questions. I mean, what can you go through the questions to sort of give people a flavor of the kind of stuff he was asking? But I mean, was it all sort of leading to, you know, basically asking you to say that you're a bad person, or was there anything in more depth about it?
All right, let's have a greatest hits of Dominic Kennedy's famous email then. I mean, actually, and Reed Johnson is as, you know, diligent as ever, has beaten me to it. We both put the link in the chat to the Countercurrents publication of my responses. I did do two streams as well, actually, where I went through the answers and did a bit of commentary on them. And Reed Johnson, as, you know, reliable as he is, has put the put the Odyssey links in there. That was back in September, shortly after I was doxxed. So questions. Why do you run a racist YouTube channel? How have you survived on YouTube? Some stuff about achieving that via using euphemisms. That was a big thing. They went on about that a lot in the podcast. They didn't like me using euphemisms. I mean, that did produce I mean, there was a litany of amazing drops and sound bites from the two podcasts, one of which was David Aaronovitch going, he's always got some form of euphemism on the go. There was also Dominic Kennedy saying that I was a really talented singer. So, I mean, just as if he wasn't getting it wrong enough by basically working on behalf of the most evil regime in history. but all right.
Well, I think you're a good singer, but then I'm not the best judge, perhaps. I don't know the technical details of it all, but you sound good to me.
Thanks. I'll take it. And yeah, you have got the Italian ancestry. He did ask, how does it feel to be Britain's most racist YouTuber? And I'd not been referred to that before. So naturally, the answer I wanted to give to that was, it feels great, you know. But I mean, again, I just rejected the whole concept. He asked why I used a false profile and name and picture. He also asked, like, why, and because this was another thing I used to do, and I did this for over 3 years, was I actually, in an attempt, like, at an OPSEC measure, I used to put on a slightly different accent, which actually wasn't even that different. I've got such a droning voice that I don't sound any different, but I used to affect, like, an attempt at a sort of southeastern accent, like I'm sort of doing now. Like, there's almost hardly any difference. Like, an American probably won't be able to tell the difference with what I was previously doing and then what I'm doing now, which is my normal voice. Asked about the steps I took to avoid detection. Why did I have the iconoclast on and bill him as a normal lad from Sunderland with moderate views, which was really just a joke rather than trying to circumvent anything. It was kind of nudge, nudge, wink, wink. I mean, people can read all the questions if they go to the countercurrents link. I mean, he asked, who do you think is onto you, activists, NGOs, or media? Were you expecting me? And I kind of said, well, look, you've answered your own question because you all serve the same purpose. A lot of daft, like, quite boneheaded questions about, like, oh, what about, you know, what about the changing class demographics of nationalism? How important is YouTube in recruiting nationalists? They acknowledged that I got onto basically the JQ, let's call it, in 2017, and then blamed Patriotic Alternative for it and YouTube, despite the fact that Patriotic Alternative didn't exist for another 2.5 years, but they tried to blame them for that. But, and which again is just like a really ham-fisted sort of hop, skip and a jump to get into the stage where they can basically try and get onto the Home Office and say, look, you know, you've got to do something about, like, white advocacy organizations. They asked how I was converted to ethnic nationalism and what my previous views were. They were trying to sort of draw a pipeline from the counter-jihad thing to us. All sorts of things. I mean, I could go on all night, but it's probably better that I don't, because obviously we've got time constraints and maybe there are other things we'll want to talk about. But it was daft.
Interesting though. I mean, as you say, it might have been geared to undermine PA in some way.
I think so.
It's interesting that you mentioned the counter jihad thing, because I was, I think that was a way into all of this for quite a few of us, including me. I used to read Gates of Vienna, Vlad Tepes' blog back in the day. That's like 2007. 8, maybe 6 as well. And that was a thing. And only later did I learn that a lot of the people who were spearheading that were actually Jews. Did you know this?
I didn't, but I'm not in the least bit surprised. I mean, you can kind of take it as read with the counter jihad.
Yeah, because at the time I didn't know anything about that. It wouldn't have occurred to me. I really didn't know anything about that. I wouldn't have taken it seriously. And even when I started my channel, I was still very skeptical about that whole thing in 2014. So it wouldn't even have occurred to me to look it up. Who are these people that I'm reading? It was only years later when I found out that, I can't remember their names now. I think Daniel Pipes, maybe. There was one who had a sort of pseudonym, and God, I've forgotten it. Fjordman. He is at least partly Jewish. Others, obviously, like Robert Spencer. Hold on a minute. Robert Spencer isn't Jewish. That's like, because
he's like a Middle Eastern Christian.
He looks Jewish, but he isn't. And then his partner in crime, there's a woman who is
Jewish.
No, not her. There was another one.
She's another Christian.
Right, but there was
Bat-Yor, maybe? Not Bat-Yor?
No, it wasn't her either. I'll never remember her name now, but she actually was.
Pamela Geller.
So a lot of them were, and it's difficult to work out what really is going on there. I guess that they were sort of stirring up anti-Muslim feeling so as to divert people from actual nationalism or to make them embarrass themselves by saying, you know, Islamophobic things. I don't know. I really don't know what they were doing. But for one reason or another, there were a lot of Jews involved in the counter-jihad movement. And I say that as if it's in the past tense. As far as I know, it doesn't really exist. I mean, I guess it sort of morphed into the Tommy Robinson stuff.
I've got to say, one thing I will say on that is, I mean, there was I don't follow any of it, but I did see there was a rambling article on, I don't know if it's like a Tommy Robinson website. It was credited to Tommy Robinson recently, addressing like the Jewish question stuff. I think after all the Kanye West kind of the whole Kanye West.
Oh
song.
Yes.
And there was real. It was kind of like the apotheosis of like Richard Madeley meets David Brent meets Alan Partridge when it came to the final section of the article, because it was subheaded "Final Thoughts, Not a Final Solution." Which was just an amazing bit of sub editing.
And what were his final thoughts? I couldn't bring myself to read all of that.
Yeah, nor could I. Nor could I. You won't be surprised to know.
Okay, yeah. Well, it'll remain a mystery then. But I did hear that he completely missed the point. That it was basically the thing that, you know, Sargon used to say, that it's not Jews, it's left wingers. So it's left wing Jews.
But then, Gavin McInnes now, yeah.
Yeah, so then, well, okay, so where are the right-wing Jews saying that white people deserve a homeland? And they don't exist.
Well, Paul Gottfried is about it, isn't it? Like, yes. Maybe Ron Unz.
Maybe David Cole.
At a stretch, if that, yeah.
Yeah, that's all I can think of. And the rest of them are saying, are doing the libertarian line of saying, well, you just shouldn't care about race. So then that enables the left. And it goes on and on. Let's move from that, because you also wanted to talk about I think you used the term, what was the term you used about by going full Orwell in 2020 and the absolute madness of the COVID pandemic and BLM. So this is how it all happened since your first appearance on Millennial. In 2019. So, and of course, you know, the world did indeed transform in 2020. I've said this many times. Let's hear it in your own, in your terms.
Well, I mean, when I was on as part of the Tassod podcast in 2019, I mean, the big thing I found myself referring back to a lot then was 2016 as a kind of a seismic year. Well, again, 2020 was another. And I've described it many times since, as you've said there, it seemed like the year that the regime, such as it is, kind of just went unashamedly went full Orwell, you know, with the concurrent. I mean, the classic example being the double standards over like anti-lockdown protests on the one hand and like Black Lives, you know, the AstroTurf Black Lives Matter protests on the other. And I suppose on the one hand, you kind of have the perception of that things of having settled back down a bit, but they've settled down into a new normal where the level of basically this was another thing the Times picked up on and really didn't like at all, and they were very curious about, was negrophilia, using the term negrophilia, which I've used.
I once did a video back in 2015. I did a very, very indignant video with that title a long time ago.
I was pretty familiar with your old catalogue, but that's one that, and I've got to be honest, had passed me by. Or maybe it hadn't, maybe I've just forgotten, but like...
I probably took it down in quite short order.
I can well imagine. But yeah, that was it, basically. We've settled into a new level of kind of like just replacement and revisionism and negrophilia. I mean, I keep referring back to it, but I suppose there's an inevitability about that because I wrote like three book chapters in response. But one of the things I'd referred to when I got doxxed, when I was asked, what do you mean by negrophilia? Well, first of all, you're a Times journalist and, you know, you've been investigations at it for 18 years. I would think, you know, your comprehension of like compound words derived from Greek and Latin are going to be better than mine, but apparently not. I think he knew fully well what it meant. But the example I cited was you'd had the Commonwealth Games closing ceremony in Birmingham that week. And it was just, again, it was just the sanctification of the people most foreign to us in their very appearance and their biology. Which again, obviously that sort of really ramped up in 2020, just to the point of the wholesale replacement of just like white presenters and whatever on television programs with blacks, because apparently it was just taken as red. Like, that's all right now. Apparently that's just what we have to do. Things settle back down, but it settles down into a new kind of a new level of kind of in, like, how would I put it? Like a new level of aggression, a new level of cultural aggression against all that is white and normative. With regard to the COVID stuff, I mean, it's really only, you know, it's easy to forget. I think for some of us, it's only, and I can't say I've focused on it that closely this year since, but it's really only a year ago that a lot of us still thought we were facing the prospect of like not being able to get into a pub or a supermarket again because we weren't prepared to take an experimental vaccine. And now for whatever reason, around about this time last year and shortly after, the powers that be seemed to climb down on that relatively quickly. Now, people can speculate as to why that was, whether they realised they'd overreach, whether they felt they actually didn't need to, whether it was simply a good faith recognition that the vaccines weren't very effective, whatever it was. But, you know, that they climbed down on the NHS vaccination mandates and so on and so forth. But, and there are many theories about the origin of this. It still leaves a trail of economic devastation. It leaves massive numbers of people suffering, you know, the lasting effects of adverse responses to the, you know, adverse reactions to the vaccines. It leaves a lot of sudden deaths. It leaves a lot of people who've died and, you know, and been bereaved because of people not being able to get medical treatment because of the lockdown policies. And I think I've been guilty of sort of going, phew, that's a relief. It's not gone full techno dystopia yet, but maybe not continuing to pay attention to what may still lie ahead as far as, like, you know, dystopian levels of technocratic overreach are concerned and all the dehumanization that'll entail. I don't know.
Oh, actually, just on the matter of sudden deaths, I read today the latest one is Canada's health director of parliamentary affairs, who led Canada's response team to COVID-19 and the vaccine rollout, has died suddenly at the age of 35.
Crikey. It's no age either, is it? Yeah, yeah.
Yeah. I mean, it's astonishing that this is this weird thing of the regime's own functionaries falling victim to the thing that they have implemented. And I remember seeing this. There was someone about a year ago who got Bell's palsy, and it was one of the people who'd been responsible for all, I can't remember who it was. It was one of these health directors, health ministers or something. And it's like, my God, you are part of this thing. And yet you have fallen foul of it, fallen victim to it. It's very, you know, it's kind of, I mean, it's poetic justice in a way, you could say. It's poetic, whatever, but it's also kind of, it's really sick. You know, even the people implementing it will be felled by it.
And yeah, and this, I mean, again, this is kind of some of what we mean when we talk about true believers, isn't it? Like, you know, we you said earlier about, there were many very intelligent people who went all in on, like, you know, wear three masks and whatever and get, like, God knows how many boosters. And they just did because it's what they believe. Yeah, it functions almost like a form of, sort of like a, like almost like a religion for them. And it's just like, it's, what's interesting about it is, I mean, something that occurs to me here is, do you remember just before last Christmas, there was kind of like an outbreak of noticing on the trailer for something called Santa Inc., which was voiced by, like, an animated thing voiced by Seth Rogen and Sarah Silverman, to name a couple?
Yes, I do remember. Yeah. It was really egregious.
Yeah, it was. And I mean, one of the and obviously we know about the backgrounds of the people writing most of that, let alone voicing it, which was, you know, documented pretty comprehensively at the time. One of the things I can remember in a bit of the dialogue from that was, like, you know, saying X amount of people still believe in Santa. And it's like, well, that's more than believing, you know, vaccines or whatever. And you can understand their sort of tetchiness about people having a skepticism about the vaccines, because ultimately it suggests a broader cynicism and level of mistrust. And if they don't trust that, they may well not trust a regime that explicitly serves the interests of people like Sarah Silverman and Seth Rogen, you know, so that they would correctly perceive something of a correlation in that. But it's this thing again, of true believers, like you said, the amount of people who just, they wholeheartedly believe it. And there's probably a lot of it in calling for things like the vaccine mandates, where they absolutely believe they're doing the right thing. I mean, I think more on their ears, I think maybe that sort of makes it all the more true. I think Justin Trudeau is a good example of this. Probably him and the people around him are such true believers. They are, and look, it didn't matter because they crushed the protests. But him and the people around him just were profoundly tone deaf in the way that they approached kind of like just the wholesale attacking of the protesters against the vaccine, you know, those protesting against the vaccine mandates in Ottawa, and kind of said, they basically did come out and say, look, it's fine to protest as long as the government and the regime agree with what you're protesting about, but otherwise you can't. It's a really bold admission. But they probably just think, well, look, we're obviously right, aren't we? You know.
Well, this relates to something that I talked about on my regular show a few weeks ago, one of the last episodes of the year, where, you remember that awful gay song, We're Coming For Your Children?
Yeah, yeah.
Remember
that?
It was awful. Yeah. And one of the guys at one point said, you won't approve of where your children go at night. And then the other one said, to protests. And it made me think, I was watching it out of sort of this morbid curiosity, this sort of entrancement that I was in watching this. And when they said that about protests, it made me think, what they're saying there is, they're talking about regime-approved protests. So yeah, there will be a sort of system and an infrastructure of that you can go and join this protest. Here's another protest. You could try this one, like a menu of different protests, and you could care about this issue and maybe this one. And so it's this sick idea of the regime giving you things to protest it to do. And it's all completely pre-approved. It's all, I mean, they're even funding it. They're organizing it.
Oh, yeah. Pushing against an open door,
It's completely fake. And I found that kind of horrifying. Now, I mean, it's not an entirely new concept to me, but it was just when this gay guy sang that line, it made it all so frighteningly clear to me. It's sort of there as a concept that you're just going to occupy people with drivel, you know, stuff that you've already decided to do, but you'll let them protest for it to be done.
Yeah.
So that they feel that they have a voice and influence on their society.
Yeah, I think, I mean, something that occurs to me is, and I used this phrase last night when I was talking about Sam Fender being given a pat on the back for writing a song called White Privilege, talking about how courageous he was. I mean, full disclosure, I actually like quite a bit of his music, but I've obviously got real kind of grievances with some of the sentiments he's expressed in some of his lyrics. But I think and this won't be the case for some people, because, you know, we all kind of, people have gone on their own sort of trajectories to get to where we are. But if you think back to when you'd hear the term stunning and brave, it was a 2016, 2017 thing, if I'm not wrong. And I think there was probably a large cohort of us at that time who, and I was certainly one of them, didn't fully understand just the degree to which so much supposed protest and dissent is entirely astroturfed and it is pushing against open doors. And I think what we were getting at without necessarily fully realizing it at the time, or fully realizing its extent and its roots, was just that, when you sort of sardonically describe something as stunning and brave, what you're getting at is, like, you know, you literally get to do that because the powers that be want it.
I think
literally paid for it, you know.
I think back then our assumption was it's fashionable. You think you're being stunning and brave, but you're only doing the fashionable thing. Now I would characterize it quite differently. It's not merely fashionable. It's enforced by the regime that you're supposedly protesting.
It's so induced.
It's all the more insidious and weird and confusing, because the whole thing is fake. It's not merely fashion. Like, it's not. Yeah. These are not fashionable ideas. They are fashionable, but they're fashionable because they're enforced and funded and astroturfed. And of course, a great example of this in our more contemporary time is Extinction Rebellion. You know, I remember when I've said this before, but I'll say it again. I remember when Fauci was being questioned in the middle of 2020, and it was on one of these committee hearings, Congress, whatever. And he said that people should avoid public gatherings. And the questioner said, "Well, what about BLM protests?" And Fauci replied, "Well, I couldn't comment on that." So, okay, that means that I should have realized, maybe I did realize at that time, this whole thing is fake. Now, like, not just the BLM protests, not just that's endorsed by the regime, but COVID as well is a load of bollocks. It's absolute nonsense because they're able to just switch off that concern when it's convenient. And of course, we saw this in London as well with people, anti-lockdown protests were public health hazards, but BLM protests were terrific. They're fine.
Because racism was the greater public health hazard, apparently.
Yes.
And you know, obviously the kind of the whole AstroTurf George Floyd thing was also gave us the, you know, the mostly peaceful meme And, you know, the spectacle of like some suspiciously Levantine looking news reporter stood in front of a, you know, like a sort of a blazing, like a sort of like a raging inferno and telling us it had all been pretty cordial, you know. This is what I mean about going full Orwell and just becoming farcical. And it'd be nice to think that they've kind of stepped back a little bit from that. But I think to a large degree, they've just kind of created a new type of normal. And normality bias is a very pernicious thing because, and I've said this many times, you know, the vast majority of people, they're pretty agreeable. They go along to get along. They don't really question things. And that isn't the problem. As exasperating as that is, that's not the problem. The problem is ultimately the fact that, you know, our elites were kind of subverted and replaced and we have something very different now. In countries in which, you know, people were ruled by their own people in their own interest, the fact that most people go along to get along would be a good thing, because if everyone was like us, it'd be murder, wouldn't it? But, you know, that normality bias is a sort of, a very pernicious thing, and most people just go along with it. Most people weren't not supporting England in the World Cup because of them taking the knee, whereas, like, most of us, if we'd supported it once, we never will again for that very reason, because it's just something that we recognise as having been taken from us. To whatever extent people, you know, people can kind of make the argument about, well, why cheer on other people playing sport anyway? Well, yeah, fine, but, like, you know, certainly not something to be done when they're ultimately weaponised against you as, like, a sort of a... kind of a billboard for racial grievance propaganda, you know.
Absolutely. And this was very interesting how this played out with the, was it the Euros last year? I've forgotten. I'm not into this stuff, but I remember watching it, the playing out. It was fascinating because, as I recall, this was my understanding of it. Was his name Southgate?
The manager.
He chose three black men to do the penalty kicks, and all three of them missed the penalty. Yeah. So it was meant to be, it was intended to be this incredible symbolism of three black men winning for England, three lions saving the day, seizing victory from the jaws of defeat at the last minute, the 11th hour.
But actually
it completely fell flat and they lost England the game.
Well, this was another thing. When I got doxxed, this was another thing. They actually basically, very proud of their work, The Times and Dominic Kennedy did an article beginning with, and let me go and find it, because it's just, this is relevant because basically one of the things that they railed against was the fact that this was the headline, Britain's most racist YouTuber rejoiced when diverse England side lost Euro 2020. Mm. And they actually began their article with... the following, and this is where you've got a question, like, do people like Dominic Kennedy, are they just utter psychopaths who don't question these things, or do they ever question how they end up in a situation where they begin a commentary on their own expose with the following? In the end, it was a Hawaiian shirt that betrayed Britain's most racist YouTuber. James Owens takes exhaustive measures to hide his identity by disguising his voice, using a pseudonym and a spoof profile and picture, and even being reluctant to disclose his genetic heritage in case it gives clues as to who he is. They began an article talking about how we doxed a guy by the fact that he boasted about wearing a Hawaiian shirt. But basically, one of the things they pointed out there was, because I did go berserk when Italy beat England on penalties, because the symbolic victory and the humiliation, basically, well, we'll call it Zog. One of the things they pointed out was that I did a Telegram post which said BLM, Black Lads Missed, which I did again yesterday when France got beaten by Argentina with all of their outfield players being black by the time of the penalty shootout. So,
I felt the same way. And again, football isn't my thing. Maybe I shouldn't comment on it. I felt a bit bad commenting on it because I don't want to piss on other people's thing, you know. But at the same time, I did think it was misguided of people to get into this. You know, there were people on our own side, on, you know, us, saying, oh, forget about the politics for now. Just let people enjoy the football. It's something that matters to them. It's something that means something to them. And I get it. You know, that was how I kind of felt about the Queen's death. You know, I thought, it's not a time for politics. Just let people have their feelings about it. It's something they're attached to. I understand all that. But the football thing was just openly anti-white. I mean, it was openly counter to our interests because clearly just being replaced. It's right there on the pitch. It's right there. It's visible. I mean, and so when they ask you to celebrate that, they're asking you to celebrate your own replacement. They're asking you to go along with it, to join in on it, and approve of it, and say that it's something fucking great. I mean, it's so subversive, you know, you couldn't make it up. And that was why I thought, it's wrong for people on our own side to be celebrating this. And I don't want to be a party pooper, but fuck's sake, you know?
You've got to draw the line somewhere, ultimately. And, like, taking the knee, as I said, basically being a platform for, like, racial humiliation is mine. I could just about support them with some black players in the team. Obviously, that's not ideal. But, yeah, after that, no.
No, yeah. Absolutely. And there was the interesting thing with the women's football this year, I think it was. Yeah, I think it was this year, where they were all white. And then, you know, it just took one fucking BBC. Sorry, I keep swearing. But it took one BBC reporter to say that they're all white. And then that started it. And, you know, we hadn't noticed that. Yeah. All of these women are white. Isn't that terrible? We're going to have to increase diversity in the women's football. And the thing is, no one used to watch women's football. It was a sort of running joke. Even I knew this, that no one cares about women's football. But suddenly, it actually was a nice thing to see an all-English team winning.
They
actually were all English. And that,
this actually was another point I made in response to a question Dominic Kennedy asked about a certain, you know, powerless, oppressed ethnic group who are so powerless and oppressed that we dare not name them in all contexts. I kind of made the point that, in the Women's World Cup, which are not long past, our public-funded broadcaster, as you've said, they produced a feature lamenting and pathologising the whiteness of the England women's football team. This when the English are by definition a white people and still a significant majority of the population in England. What are we to say of the fact that, you know, if that can happen, then according to a documentary headed by Sir Trevor Phillips, the you know, former head of the Commission for Racial Equality, there's a foreign ethno-religious group in this country whose individual members are each entitled to citizenship in another country, who are 40 times more likely to be billionaires than the rest of the population, over twice as wealthy as the rest of the population on average, roughly seven times better represented in parliament per capita, three times more likely to hold senior management positions within FTSE 100 companies, and four times more likely to be non-executive directors in banking. If our state broadcaster can decry the England women's football team for being too English, but we've got to remain silent on the colossally disproportionate wealth, power and influence of foreign groups like that in our own country, you have to question the legitimacy and the intentions of those who rule over us, surely. That was the question I put to him. I put many questions to him. Of course, he didn't answer them. Yeah,
that's an excellent, that's a fantastic question there. Very well framed. I mean, that was one question I was going to ask you earlier. Did he respond to any of these questions that you put to him, or did he just move on to the next question?
Oh, no, nothing. No, I answered all in one go and I never heard from him again. So, yeah, there we are.
Yeah. You see, I got contacted, I can't even remember who it was by now, about a year and a half ago on something. And no idea what this was, what this was about. But anyway, I replied to them just quoting, because it was asking, why do you think that Britain should be for the British people? And that kind of thing. And so I just linked them to, I said, I agree with the ADL. On what they say about Israel. And I quoted the ADL talking about Israel. And it was that famous quote saying, Israel cannot be expected to undermine its own sovereignty by replacing its native population, etc. And it was basically just a statement of nationalism for Israel, for the Jews. And he did mention, I'm sorry, I can't remember where this was or who this was, but I think it might have actually been Jason Wills. Let me see if I can. It doesn't matter now. It'll take too long to find out. But he did mention this, that I'd said this in his article, that I'd replied to him in this way. And he said that nationalists or racists, I can't remember the term he used, often falsely draw this comparison with Israel. And he didn't say why it was a false comparison. He didn't say why they've got the right to a homeland. They've got the right to an ethnostate, but we haven't. It is just a fucking, just asserted that it's a false comparison. I mean, it's really sickening. I think it was Jason Wilson. I thought that was probably the best way that you can reply to this stuff, is to use effectively their own words against them, because there is enough material there.
Or just make them justify themselves. Like, you know, the other way you could go, if you're asked, like, why do you want Britain to be mostly for the British people? You'd say, well, clues in the name, innit? Like, have you got an argument as to why it should be anything else?
Yes.
You know?
Yes.
And because these people are, they're generally not sort of accustomed to having to justify themselves, because ultimately they basically received their program and have been sent off into the worlds to do the bidding of the powers that be. They've only got it at a very basic level, so you can make them blue screen quite easily. And it's, with people like your Dominic Kennedys, I do wonder about this sometimes. Are they, you know, are they as profoundly mediocre as they come across, or is that all part of their act to try and lure you into saying something that's going to get you in trouble? And I think there's an element of both, but I do think there is a genuine thing of they are just genuinely like they have a pathological degree of compliance relative to us.
Yes, it's a really interesting question. And I've just looked it up, and it was Jason Wilson. He contacted me because they were doing an SPLC hit piece about me at some point, January this year, actually. It is a really interesting question. How much are they even aware? And then it gets you to the NPC thing. You know, are they just following orders, ironically enough? Mm. Do they actually think about anything that they're doing? And are they capable of processing stuff with an open mind, or is it always subject to the conditioning that they've received? I think it is the latter. And even though they are clearly quite bright people, it's a very strange thing. The whole NPC thing is fascinating because it's so troubling. You know, the implications of it are pretty damn frightening and inconvenient for us, because it means that the majority of the public, of the human race, just don't think in the way that we think. They're simply not capable of it. It doesn't even occur to them that they could be like that. That they could evaluate things on their own. But again, as I've said before, that is a fascinating concept and worrying and all that. But then it resolves to, well, this is probably how most people need to be. This is probably without this, you'd have constant arguments. Nothing would get done. There wouldn't be any consensus in society. So, you know, maybe that's just the animal that we are. But a small percentage of us do have genuine independence of thought. And, that's as much a blessing as a curse.
Yeah, that's something you can be taught as well. But obviously the point is most people aren't going to be taught it because, you know, what does independence of thought lead to? Well, it leads to you being like us. And I don't want to say that in a self-aggrandizing way, because, I mean, and again, this was another point I made in my answer, like, is that, you know, one of my answers, for all but the most intelligent and courageous people, and I've never been either, introduction to the correct vocabulary and rhetoric and the resulting knowledge and sense of empowerment and moral justification are required to reject the concept of so-called racism outright. Loads of people don't like it, but they're not rhetorically equipped, and they don't have the vocabulary to deconstruct it. And that's purposely kept from them, because obviously that'd be an incredibly dangerous thing for the present order were it disseminated. That's what I mean about the fact that they play ominous music, an ominous kind of like bed of like soundscaping under Donald Kennedy. Words about rejecting racism. Yeah,
it's in the same way that they talk about X, Y, or Z is a threat to our democracy. What they mean is it's a threat to our status quo. It's a threat to the way we live. It's a threat to everything we know. So that is scary for them. I mean, they're using the word democracy rather erroneously, but still what they mean is their statement is still true in the sense that this would mess things up.
This is the classic thing of trying to take what is a threat to their regime and present it as a threat to the wider public so that they will kind of self-police.
Yes.
You know? Particularly, I mean, I think what you see in a lot of this is the kind of the threat perception and the threat triggers of a particular foreign group being imbued on a kind of a mass population under their yoke, because there's not enough of them to combat it on their own. So they basically need to, you know, they need to turn the mass against the people that are actually want to act in the interest of the mass, essentially.
Yes.
By making kind of your Gentiles, let's call us what we are, perceive threat in the way that they perceive threat to their power.
Let me, since I've found this thing, I might as well read it out to you, because it's quite funny. It might bring back some uncomfortable memories of your own experience. This was in January this year, and it was Jason Wilson off the SPLC. And I'm going to read out the whole email that he sent me. It's quite interesting. Not an interview request, just a request for comment. I'm a reporter with the Southern Poverty Law Center's Hate Watch. We're a civil rights organization based in Montgomery, Alabama. A range of organisations have described you as a white supremacist and a white nationalist. How would you respond to that? That's the first question. So
how long have you got?
You're an evil piece of shit. What do you have to say about that? And the next one. Others have pointed to your promotion of conspiracy theories, including anti-Semitic conspiracy theories, and the idea that immigration will inevitably lead to civil conflict. How would you respond to that? Your millennial streams in December appear, this is referring to last year's millennial, appear to promote a range of people whose political positions have been widely characterized as white nationalist or white supremacist. Why did you feel you needed to do that? And then he asked me something else about some tawdry allegations because he wanted to get some dirt. He was hoping to get dirt on me. So that was it. That was it. So four questions, all of them designed to entrap me and get me to basically say, yeah, you're right. I'm a piece of shit. I'm a really bad guy. It's pathetic. But of course, that is his job. I mean, he's working for, he's working for the SPLC. Now, I mean, you could say it would actually be worse if he were a journalist working for a supposedly impartial newspaper because and that does happen. And in your case, that is exactly what happened. And in my case, it's exactly what happened.
Oldest newspaper of record in the world, and he's going after an autistic bloke who was streaming to 120 people and like mostly doing impressions of Kermit the Frog singing advert jingles. the cutting edge of white resistance, apparently.
But the newspapers, and this is the thing: the way that a journalist from a newspaper contacts you is really very much the same. It's indistinguishable from the way that an activist from the SPLC would approach you. That's probably very telling in itself, I think.
Yeah, regime. Yeah, it's all one regime. Yeah.
Yeah.
This is basically why I told Dominic Kennedy I saw no distinction between NGOs, activists, and the media. Like, ultimately.
Yeah. That perhaps brings us to, unless you want to, do you want to say anything about Ukraine and the Russia-Ukraine conflict?
I don't think I've got a lot to say about that, to be honest. I think I mentioned them at the time when we discussed what might come up, you know, if I were going to appear. But I don't think I've got loads to say. I mean, what I will say briefly on Russia and Ukraine is it's certainly been a show of mask-off contempt for the populations under the rule of the various governments of this regime. Obviously, I know you've talked a bit about Nord Stream on here and just the seemingly flagrant, like, just disregard for any pretense that it was anything other than just like a kind of like a Western or NATO sabotage to put the Germans in such a difficult position. And obviously just what we're all living through now with the energy costs. I mean, the dispiriting thing about it is, and you know, we talked about the whole sort of NPC phenomenon, and we've now kind of arising from this war, got the current thing, you know, the idea of the current thing. Dispiritingly, even on the nearest reaches of the non-dissident right, nearest as in the furthest to the right, so closest to us, there seems to be kind of negligible cynicism about all of this and about the kind of megalomaniacal geopolitical agendas of, you know, of basically of Judeo-America and NATO. Not loads else to say about that, to be honest, because we kind of watched this space with it. It seems to be at a kind of a stalemate. It's not been a success for Russia so far. It's cost, you know, Western governments and Western taxpayers a hell of a lot of money, both in terms of just weapons and everything else. The Canadians are apparently just depleting their own weapons, you know, stockpiles for it. And then, you know, all whilst people are, you know, freezing. But
awful,
I've got tons else to add on that, really.
It's a very ugly situation. What would you say about the idea that the whole COVID thing happened, was implemented by a different elite from the one that you've just alluded to? Or do you think it was the same elite or what?
As in a kind of a like the technocratic elite, you know, people talk about obviously, you know, the sort of World Health Organization, World Economic Forum. It's probably, there are going to be a lot of people better placed to comment on that than me, but I mean, I think, you know, there are a lot of theories about the origin of COVID, aren't they? I mean, the sort of the accepted one, though the powers that be don't seem to like it being talked about too much, is the idea that it was basically American pharmaceutical companies probably hand in glove with, you know, the actual American state doing, you know, gain of function research in China, which would be illegal in America. And it arose from that. That's the good faith assumption of it, which they don't seem to like. You know, there are obviously many other theories, as it being a deliberately instigated thing. So I really don't know. I'm probably not very well placed to comment on that because I can't say I've looked at the competing theories in depth. But I mean, as to the things we saw subsequently, yeah, I mean, it was a trail of devastation, wasn't it? But I mean, I suppose it goes back to one of the things I was saying earlier on about true believers. And I think, yeah, you probably do have a lot of true believers in, you know, capital S science, capital P progress, in positions of like executive power in a lot of these sort of transnational bodies and corporations and whatever else. And they genuinely kind of do believe their own dogma about all of this. And like, oh, the vaccine's going to save us all from something that's actually unpleasant and quite contagious, but really not that lethal. I don't know. What do you think?
I don't know. And this is why I asked you, because to me, this is an open question and an ongoing question and a significant question. There was an article published on Majority Rights last year called Passing the Contest of Elites. And it was a very short article, but very interesting because it suggested that there are multiple elites active and very powerful at the same time. And one of them is the old one that we, you know, we're very familiar with, sort of Zio neocon warmongering, and the other is technocratic and not actually as tribal as the other one. I mean, there are certainly like Alfred Bourla and so on. There are definitely Jews involved in it, but not to the same extent. It's interesting. And one of the things that came up with this is that the idea that Klaus Schwab is Jewish. Apparently he isn't. Apparently he's not. There was a false thing going around that his mother was a Rothschild. Apparently that's not true.
It's annoying when the waters get muddied with that kind of thing. Like, I mean, a sort of a real annoyance of mine lately has been like when people fabricate tweets. That's really annoying.
And apparently, I think there's some website that enables you to do that. So it's very easy. You know, it's like a meme generator. You can just fabricate a tweet. It's quite annoying. All right. So then the last thing that you wanted to talk about, and this is much more contemporary, is the Kanye West thing. And you said to me, I'll just read out what you said to me here, that I think the Kanye West thing has gone on long enough now that it has lasting significance from the point of view of analysing how the powers that be respond to and have in this case arguably mishandled it, high-profile dissent. So there you go. What would you say?
I mean, obviously, that's going back a little while. And I think that was beginning of November, wasn't it? So we were all struck at that time by the fact that it persisted as long as it had and he'd basically not been put back in his box and cowed, basically, which is an interesting thing in itself, because I mean, you could even argue there's a racial dimension to that, of not to take too much away from Kanye West, but there's even a racial dimension to that, where like the temperament of the average white person in his position would be like, oh crikey, there are real consequences here, I better shut up. Whereas there's an element with this almost of like from the mouths of babes, if you see what I'm saying, you know, an emperor's new clothes. I always remember Morgoth making this point before. I think it was regarding Nicki Minaj of all people, basically speaking out of turn about vaccine side effects and saying this is one of the problems with kind of like idealizing and massively promoting people of that race, is like you can't necessarily rely upon them to respond in quite such an orderly manner in terms of their compliance with regime narratives and dogma in all cases. But I mean, it seems to, it's quieted down a bit now because, you know, the stream appearances and whatever seem to have steadily come to a stop with Kanye West. But, you know, it seems to, and you can speculate as to why this was, but with regard to things like the ADL, and when we say the ADL, we're then basically getting into all of the strings they can pull and all the people they can lean on and basically ethnic networking. It seemed to take them a while to figure out how to deal with it. Now, that could either suggest that the ADL and so on, you know, and the sort of people who fund them and back them and work with them and all of their kind of lobbying clout don't, in its totality, you know, it doesn't actually have access to the sort of absolute power we would sometimes ascribe to them. But on the other, like, I don't know, were they taking the view that if they gave the guy enough rope, he'd sort of throttle his own line of argument by just being weird and mad and discrediting it? Like, you know, was Milo Yiannopoulos' brief involvement, which coincided with the Alex Jones appearance and him wearing that daft mask and coming out with some quite outlandish quotes about Hitler and whatever, was that any part of an attempt to sort of, give enough rope, so to speak? I don't know. I think a lot of us, sort of bereft as we often are of any, as we often feel of any sort of hope for imminent change, we've almost kind of checked out, and we just look at events and laugh at them. We look at events kind of cynically and irreverently, and we laugh at them. So we think, well, this is great. He's being transgressive and, you know, saying the unsayable. And that definitely has its own benefit. Is it going to herald a revolution? No, I don't think it is. But we look at a lot of that sort of stuff and we laugh at it, and people outside our community perhaps don't. On the other hand, this is there are two other things I would say in it. And the first one is, has anyone seen all of this? And particularly with the way the ADL and Jonathan Greenblatt have responded very heavy-handedly, very kind of neurotically and tyrannically, has anyone seen it and become less open than they previously were to the idea of the group of people in question wielding grossly disproportionate power and doing so quite malevolently? I don't know. I doubt it. The other thing I would say is, if a thought hasn't escaped me, and it may have, was basically, it may come back to me. It's kind of escaped me now. But yeah, I don't know if you've got anything to say in response to that.
No, it's fine. I mean, it has been a bit of a storyline with Kanye West, because it started off with him. He was on fire and he was on top and it was great. And, you know, he was and he made the ADL look stupid. And Elon Musk made the ADL look stupid. And it was maybe inadvertently. And it was all great. And then Kanye West did that Alex Jones interview wearing the mask and looking ridiculous. And then with that net, the fishing net thing. And
some of us look at that in terms of meme potential and finding it funny, because we're so inured to how bad things are. We kind of just tend to laugh at things.
From my perspective, that sort of ruined it, because it made the, it appeared to vindicate the ADL. It made them look like, that this guy is crazy and he's saying dangerous things. Yeah. And so it's not measured anymore. It's not thoughtful anymore. It's not really truthful anymore. It's just sort of random drivelings. And or at least that's how it came across to the general public. So, And then shortly after that, or immediately after that, Elon Musk seemed to acquiesce to the ADL. So I suspect that, I mean, you never know, and you know, you can only speculate, but I suspect that if Kanye West hadn't done that interview, or if it had been done very differently, just sensibly, you know, like his the ones he did with Lex Fridman and Tim Pool, then things would be different now. I don't know. But actually and of course it does relate to the whole Twitter Elon Musk thing. But the latest there, and it's just come up while you and I have been talking, is that apparently the rumors now, so this is from someone called Chuck Colesto, rumors now swirling that Donald Trump's son-in-law, Jared Kushner, has emerged as Elon Musk's pick for the Twitter CEO.
They were photographed together at the World Cup final yesterday, and I mean that can't be good news, can it? I mean, basically, the man who ultimately ensured that Trump did everything for Israel when he was in office, but did nothing for white people.
Yeah, he did everything wrong. I mean, he did everything to destroy his own support base. Absolutely, it seems to have always been Jared Kushner, and it was ominous to see him photographed with Elon Musk. And, you know, he's looking sinister. He's like the lurch figure. And Elon Musk is looking downcast, miserable. And to me, it's all very, it's all very telling. You know, it looks like, okay, this is another, like Trump, this is another billionaire, massive, rich, powerful guy who thought that he could do it all on his own. Didn't have didn't have networking, didn't have the nepotism and whatever. And he's been completely outflanked.
Yeah. The thing I was going to say, actually, regarding Kanye West and the potential last insignificance, and I did make this point early on, is as much of a spectacle as this is now when it was kind of happening, you know, contemporaneously, it's like it's one man. Now, the real test for the present order and how it manages these things would be, what happens if there's then another very high profile person who comes out and does the same thing, and then another, and then another, and it becomes like an outbreak of basically speaking out about certain things? That'd be more of a test, but I suspect we're not going to see that. But if we did, that's when it would get more interesting. But yeah, that was my only other thought on it, really, to be honest. But I mean, as you've said, if Jared Kushner is going to be CEO of Twitter, then yeah, expect a load of neocon stuff to be permissible, but nothing to the right of that, because, you know, get to the right of that and it becomes a little bit too pro-white, obviously.
Oh, yeah. The whole thing is fucked. If he is the new CEO, it's over. It's done.
Yeah.
It just seems amazing that it's the same guy who castrated Donald Trump in office, who would now castrate Elon Musk. It's really quite amazing to see that. That's an ongoing story. We'll see how it goes. But in the meantime, this has been a really interesting discussion. So I've enjoyed it, and I think the audience have enjoyed it too. All right. Is there anything else you'd want to say about any of the stuff we've talked about?
No, I don't think so. I think we've covered everything I would have wanted to say, and yeah, I've thoroughly enjoyed it. Yeah, thanks for having me on, yeah.
Okay, excellent. Well, I'll be back in 20 minutes with, already forgotten. Let me see who the next person is.
Faust, wasn't it?
Yes, it's Faust. It's Dutch Faust. And he's going to talk about the tractor protest in the Netherlands. And all the shutting down the farms and all that. So that should be interesting. Okay. In the meantime, Ayatollah, thank you for appearing on Millennial 8.
Thanks for having me. Merry Christmas, everybody. Cheers.
Excellent. All right. I'll be back soon. Bye-bye for now.
We hope you're enjoying Millennial. The show must go on, but it needs your help. T-shirts and mugs and other wondrous gifts are available in the merchandise store. Impress your family, friends, colleagues, and business partners with these incredible items. Millennial amounts to 3 months of work for the vile blogger. Please help him continue. Until next time, enjoy the show and spread the word.